You are tuning into Sabah al-Muslim on Radio Islam International. The newly released book, Forsberg Fighter, The Journey of an MK Volunteer, which is the life story of Amin Kaji, as told to Terry Bell. Amin Kaji joins us in the studio this morning. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam.
Really nice to have you with us at the studios of Radio Islam International. First and foremost, what inspired you to tell your story so many years later?
It all started with my grandchildren. My grandchildren were hearing stories about me. And I felt it would be, I would do justice by giving them the truth of what they know about me rather than what they were thinking I am. So that was the initial period. Also, I wanted to let them have the history of my background. I come from India. My parents come from India. I'm from South Africa. And what actually made me go into the political struggle so they would have a better understanding of my life. That was the main issue.
You speak about your early childhood and also now focusing on the fact that you come, or your origins from India and all of that. In the opening pages, you speak about your time at Mia's Farm. Now, tell us more about that and the need to share that and to share it in a way that you feel is brutally honest and stating facts as it is.
Yeah. I think looking back on how Islam is taught today and how it was taught at that time are two different situations completely. It was a very difficult situation. I think there was a lot of punishment, a lot of abuse, a lot of bullying. The ideal was that you had to learn the Quran. Beyond that, there was nothing else. And I think with all the pressures and the punishments, you did learn the Quran, but it was under duress. It was not made, it wasn't given, you had no idea what the Quran said to you. You just had to recite it. You had to learn it off. And that was it. Very little explanation. I think the punishments were the most brutal part of my stay in Mia's Farm. There was no monitoring of how people were treated. It was a very difficult time. I was a very young boy at that time. I had left home. I had left my family. So it was a very difficult period.
Why the need to share all of that?
I mean, it is to show, basically, what the institutions were like at that particular time, as far as Islam was concerned. So, and what it is now, where there is far more compassionate, there's far more explanations, people are looking to close to circumstances of children, and I think I'm not sure what is happening. And there's probably far less punishment, the type of punishment that we were being meted out at that time.
Now then, your entry into politics and resisting the oppression as well as the apartheid regime at that time, what motivated you at that point of your life? As a youngster, just around passing through your teens, around 19 years old, what was your inspiration at that time?
I think the inspiration was more because you were being deprived of your education. That was the most important thing. You came to realize that you were a third class citizen. The color of your skin was the factor which decided in which direction you led your life. The group areas came in, and one of the things that the government did is they closed most of our schools and move them to lands. This was to make sure that the parents would move to lands as well. Of course, then the Transvaal Indian Congress opened up the school in opposition to the government. It was called Central Indian High School. You had all these high political profile teachers who had spent time in prison and everything. Of course, this wears off on you. You see the situation far clearly of what's happening. So that was the first initial period. In the meantime, my brother Yusuf was also involved in politics. And we used to sit and discuss things at home. And from there, of course, it led from one thing to another.
Then you got involved in what was supposed to have been the armed struggle, and you went off out of the country. What then inspired you in that particular direction? Because there were not many from your type of a background, Indian Muslim, who went in that direction.
Whenever we did the peripheral things, we were leafleting, we were putting slogans, we were printing, we were calling strikes and everything. At every juncture, the government would pass a law to try and block you from doing that. And it appears, I mean, we as young people, 18, 17, 18, 19 years old, we felt that this is not getting us anywhere as far as the struggle is concerned. And we thought there should be some form of armed struggle that should be taking place within the country. Well, nobody said anything to us, but I think December 1961, when the first explosions went off, and Umkhonto Sizwe was born. Being in a political movement already for a few years, we were approached by Paul Joseph, if we wanted to join the armed struggle, that myself and Umar Bamji comes from a very background. His father was a Maulvi Bamji, very well known at that time during our time here. His father died at a very early age, and he had left school to help his family. So the two of us were asked if we would go over, and we were told that we'd go over for 6 months. We'd be trained in some sort of armed struggle, what we assumed was guerrilla warfare, and we'd be out of the country for 6 months. And of course, that's what pushed us forward.
At that time, were you already a member of any political party?
I was a member of the Transvaal Indian Youth Congress at that time, which was affiliated to the Transvaal Indian Congress.
And that was affiliated to the ANC?
That was affiliated to the Congress Alliance, yes, which is affiliated to the Congress Alliance, yes.
What was your expectations when you went out now to become active within Umkhonto Sizwe? Were you planning to get into the guerrilla warfare itself?
Of course, that was the idea. But it was not to sort of come in and start a war or something like that. It's a very limited protected struggle that we were thinking about. We were hoping to go in, return within 6 months. I was fortunate enough, Umar and I were fortunate enough to have passports to go out legally and come back legally, to set up a network, to set up bases. From the training that we got, this was the idea. And I think the struggle was in a direction where we were just going to stir things up initially to shake the government. And now hoping, like all revolutionary warfares, they sort of start taking up and picking up to making it a massive insurrection.
The words were said to you, "You are guilty of treason and the penalty is death." What went through your mind at that time when you heard those words?
I froze. And I thought, "My God, I'm going to die." And I started praying. It's very difficult in words to express how you feel when somebody is passing a death sentence. The ANC was always against the death sentence. And here I'm in a movement which I'm supposed to belong, which I belong to. I found that I've been sentenced to death. I think I must have been the first person in South Africa to be sentenced to death by the ANC and Umkhonto.
Yes, now this obviously has lots of background to it, the infighting with the ANC, within the Umkhonto Sizwe, the ANC, the factions, the Khoisan faction, the Zulu faction, and all of that. Fill us in, put us into perspective on what was some of the various factions and what were the factors that led to these divisions and the role players.
What happened is, when we trained, firstly, I didn't come back in 6 months. I completed my training in Czechoslovakia, and it was 2 years later that I came to what was known as a transit camp in Tanzania.
Firstly, when you left South Africa, it was to Tanzania.
We went to Tanzania.
What was the camp called?
No. When we first left, we were told to report to Dar es Salaam to the ANC officers. When we got there, you must know, nobody knew about us being members of Umkhonto. It was totally very secretive. So nobody knew what was the purpose of us going out. So we thought we were going for a holiday to Mombasa. That was the excuse that we gave to people. So the family and everybody were impressed, because the previous year we had a group of teachers that had come from Mombasa and we had established contacts. And as a result, we thought we'd go and visit them. So that the idea was to go up to Dar es Salaam, get off the boat, get to the ANC, and from there to be sent for training. That was the original idea. When we go to the ANC office, everybody was totally shocked. Who are these guys? Informers, infiltrators. And a lot of suspicion took place. So we were told to continue to Mombasa, and we'll contact you. So we went to Mombasa and we waited, nothing happened. So we came back to Dar es Salaam. Coming back to Dar es Salaam, what are you people doing here? We said, we'll contact you. He said, well, you know, you said we should be home within 6 months. We stayed in Dar es Salaam for about 3 weeks. And then Jimmy Adeba came up and told us, right, get ready, you're going to London. Now, we thought, why are we going to London? Because everybody that is coming to Dar es Salaam are sent for training from here. And they said, you're going to see Dr. Dadu. And this sort of made me suspicious. Is it because we're Indians and we're not part of the struggle? And I think that was the first eye-opener. So that's what actually happened. And then from there, we were sent to Czechoslovakia. We spent 3 months as tourists in London. Had a very nice time. Enjoying ourselves.
The expenses, was that from your own money?
No. We had some money on us. But Dr. Dadu financed us during our stay in London. We had an allowance, on a weekly allowance. Our rent was paid. So everything was sorted out. There's no problems as far as that's concerned. And, of course, coming into Kongwa, the camp, which was a transit camp, which we thought we'd be there for 2 months, and slowly we'd be infiltrated into South Africa. That was the original idea. Apparently, this did not happen. What happened is we languished in these camps for 2 years, 3 years, some for 4 years, and there was no movement. And when you put 400 people together in a place, all being told that they had come out to go and fight in South Africa, and nothing has been happening. Frustration set in, divisions occur, big clashes between, firstly on a total provincial basis, Transvaal, Natal, Cape Province. And this really, you know, just demoralized everybody. There was a lack of food at points, the OEU was cutting funds, illnesses had taken place. So it was a very difficult time for all of us.
Yes, now, your speciality, what sort of training did you get in Czechoslovakia? We understand that you were a homemade bomb specialist.
That's right, that was my speciality. That's what I was trained in, but I was trained in overall, basically, in guerrilla warfare.
So how do you make a homemade bomb?
My memory lapsed. there's a lapse in memory. I mean, I remember all the terms and this, but it's very difficult. I don't think I should advertise that on the air.
Where did you get your training in Czechoslovakia? What sort of a training regime did you have to go through, and who were the trainees or the trainers?
The trainers were Czech officers, basically speaking. What we did is we did... They initially trained us for the first few months in conventional warfare. And we then had a chat with them and we said, no, we'd like to guerrilla warfare, urban warfare. That's what we needed, because that is what we were going to start our struggle in South Africa. So we did a lot in terms of topography, in terms of our small arms, big arms. I drove a tank. Shot with howitzers, 147 millimeter guns, anti-tank guns. So we had a wide range of experience, but we concentrated on guerrilla warfare. And then everything else, Umar was specializing in small arms, I was specializing in explosives. And some were trained in communication. So it was a wide range of training.
You're listening to an interview on Radio Islam International. I have in the studios of Radio Islam, Amin Kaji, who has now put together his book, Fordsburg Fighter, The Journey of an MK Volunteer, as told to Terry Bell, and he's with us chatting about his experience and his book this morning. Now with regards to the aspect of joining the MK, and the perspective that you've given is a deeply divided organization, or how we could refer to it, a movement, fight for leadership. This is a different perspective that, you know, we don't really hear about these things. People generally talk about all the positives when you reflect, and this is now really insight. Were you scared to say the story as it is, to spill the beans and, you know, let it out into the public?
The idea was just for my grandchildren. That was the idea. I had no intentions of putting this in the public domain. There's no intention. Terry Bell, who's a journalist, who was also in Africa, was in Morogoro in Tanzania, had many experiences that time as well. Excuse me. And he came over. And we first met in 1980 through my brother. He's a very good friend of my brother, because the three of them was Nanu Jashmat and them carried out a number of activities here. And he heard my story of what had happened. This was in the 1980s. He came back in the 2000s, and one day he just came up to me and he said, "Look, I think what I need to do is," he wanted to record my story. And he brought something, some contraption, and he didn't know how to use it. But by then I'd written about 90 pages of the book already. So I put him on a laptop and I said, "Read this." And he read it. Now, this was about 3-4 years ago. And then I continued writing, and then he came back 2 years later, and then he came back last year, and I just about completed the book. And he was so insistent. He says it's a part of the story. We were the first group of people, that were in an armed struggle, that was supposed to be in an armed struggle. We were military trained. We were in Congo. We were 300-400 people. People had trained in Algeria, China, Egypt, in the Soviet Union. We were from Czechoslovakia, that was mainly from Moscow, Tashkent, and Odessa. So we had a lot of group of people who were trained in different strategies and everything, and we all came together to set up this network. And the frustrations had taken place and everything. And Terry said, "Look, people have to know what happened at that time. Paul Joseph spoke to me, Professor Dennis Goldberg, friends of mine, and they put a lot of pressure on me. And I suppose I finally gave away. And I said, okay, let's publish the book." And the idea was simply to let the book go on and let people read it.
Yes. Tell us about the power struggles within ANC at that time, and who were the role players, and what were some of the issues?
Well, it's very difficult to say. The power struggle was basically, because I think when the Congo camp, the structure, when they did the structure of the people in charge, it appears that most of the people they were put there were from the Cape Province.
Was it Nkosa?
Mainly from the Nkosa side, yeah. Now, I was ignorant in these matters. I didn't know about these things. This was an eye-opener that there were divisions. We also have to go to say that there were a lot of... It's up recently when I've been talking to people, there were divisions in the Indian Congress, which I wasn't aware of. Personality clashes. So there's a lot of personality clashes that were taking place. And I think the image that was created at that time was that this was the causes, and there's a problem between the different tribes. It's only when a group of 29 people, known as Operation 29, which is in my book, this whole group came from Natal. And out of frustration in 1966, they took hold of the truck and they were going to confront the leadership to say, "Look, we've been here since 1964. There's no movement of going to South Africa. We want to know what is happening." And I think that actually stirred up everything, because it looked like just purely a Zulu Zola, a Xhosa thing. That's what it was. That was the whole impression, and that's what. And it filtered down to that particular level at that time. So you had people who wanted power, who wanted to show that, the Xhosa, because the Zulu had an impressive history about their struggle with Setswayo, with Dingaan and everything. And I think people are very keen to show that it was a cause of struggle and they were going to be in power. Now, I did not learn the vernacular, so you must know I'm bringing my information from the people I'm talking in the camp, who are translating to me what is being said and how it is. So my story is based a lot on these people giving me information about what, who, about Joe Modise, about the various people, Amrut Makiwane, about Jack Khatib, about Archie Sebeko, Chris Hani. So there's a lot of people talking about these people, and I came to know more about them, of what they were before we came to Kongwa. But things just didn't work out. Everything went wrong. And I think that was a tragedy for us. I mean, there was a big problem, because we didn't have too many friendly borders to infiltrate people in. But I think within 2 years, they could have at least infiltrated 200-300 people in small groups into South Africa.
You are a deserter. Do you accept the title?
I volunteered. I wasn't conscripted. That is what I said. I joined a movement where I was very impressed by what it stood for, the Freedom Charter. If an organization goes against all those basic principles which were enshrined in the start, I can't become part of that movement. And as a volunteer, I took exit. I walked away from it, because I was not going to be a party to what was happening in the movement at that time.
Yes, you speak about the fact that, you know, there were those who remained loyal, and there were those who had been caught in all these side issues and lost the objective of the focus. From your point of view, as you join the MK now, how would you have liked to seen the standing up and challenging of the apartheid regime? And if you look at how things did eventually unfold, are you disappointed at the path that it did follow?
Firstly, I've got to bow down to the people who died in the struggle. We, the group of people that were fighting, Rhodesian soldiers, not South African soldiers, probably a few of them, the people that were fighting in Angola, the UNITA forces. My book is from the first period. There's another book that has come out, If We Must Die, by Stanley Manong, who will give you an example of what was happening in Angola. While we suffered a great deal, I think the tragedy of Angola is now known. There's a book by Tula Simpson, who gives records from archives of what had happened in the struggle. Taking that into perspective, I think what happened was the correct way. Because you must know, we hadn't liberated a single inch of South Africa. That is the starting point. You know, when you're talking about armed struggle, you're holding some territory. This didn't happen at all.
Why didn't it happen?
Because the struggle did not come into South Africa. Most of the struggle was taking place outside of South Africa, internally, and fighting Rhodesian and UNITA forces. So it didn't happen. Incompetence, difficulties in infiltrating people. I mean, there's so many factors there. So as far as I'm, but those that died in battle, knowing what the odds were, because as a guerrilla fighter, you're supposed to know your territory, you're supposed to have established bases years ago, you're supposed to have known the population. Our people are fighting in areas where they didn't know the territory, where they didn't know the language, they hadn't established bases, they were going with minimum ammunition arms, and they fought, and many died. And to them I take my hat off.
Obviously, you went with that objective to get training and to execute some sort of guerrilla attacks in South Africa. While leaving South Africa and throughout your stay there, you may have had some targets, some plans in mind. What were those plans? What would you have done had you come to South Africa under that pretext to execute a guerrilla attack?
I think that would have, the National High Command would have set up what the strategy that we should apply, what tactics we
but
should
on a personal
apply.
Level, there must have been something.
Oh yes, we had a basic idea. The idea was to come into South Africa. I mean, during the 60s. Set up bases, set up an underground network, set up printing fences, build fences with the local population, make contacts, everything, find out where the police stations are, where the military installations are, where the explosives are kept, what type of chemicals are available. That was the basic idea. And I think the basic idea for the struggle initially was not to go out and kill people. I think it was to target economic targets, to blow up things, to put pressure on the government to come down and to meet the leaders of the Congress alliances and to start negotiating for a settlement.
If we had to go that route and if things had to follow that path, do you think we'd have been in a different situation scenario today?
Possibly. Possibly. Because what we did is, the international pressure was so heavy. The UDF was very active at the time. The Soweto uprising was there. I mean, there was a lot of things happening at the time. So the conditions, we had to create conditions that were favorable and where we were negotiated from a position of strength. That was the target, and that's what was supposed to happen.
Towards the end of the book, you speak about the fact that the Mkhonto Sizwe never really lifted arms, and the Soweto uprising, which was spontaneous and had just come up on, you know, where people were willing to give their lives, actually did more for the liberation of the country. Please elaborate on that.
Well, that was the pressure, because I think the frustration of nothing happening in the country at that particular time. And with the UDF, with the Soweto uprising, with more people going out to train and everything, that put pressure on the government. But I think the other pressure that was coming was the international pressure on the government, the economic situation, where there were boycotts, you know, where a lot of things were happening, the sports boycott, the economic boycott that was taking place, sanctions, you know, that were taking place. And this was affecting the South African economy. And the business people in this country realized that they had to move forward and they had to bring about a settlement. So I think that is what I put all the pressure on.
The negotiated settlement, did the ANC settle for too little?
Well, we have to wait and see, because I know it's 20 years into it, probably a little. It's a very difficult situation now. You're in a very difficult crisis. I don't know if the route was set for the type of things that are happening during the time when people were in exile. We'll have to wait and see what the situation turned out to be.
Yes, now there's political freedom, but economic freedom has not yet come to the people. Would you agree with that sentiment on the issue of economic freedom?
Well, it's very interesting, because in the 1992, I met Joe Modise in London, and we had lunch together at Abdullah Yassid's place and Harleen's place. I just popped in, and there he was, and we sat in there. And after lunch, we were sitting and we were sort of looking back, looking to the future and everything. And I'd like to say, was his comment. He said, "Comrade Amin, we may have political freedom, but we will not have economic freedom." And that was Joe Modise's words.
So what happened with yourself? What path did you follow when you then left the training camp and then returned to South Africa?
No, I did not return to South Africa at all. I didn't join the other side, let's put it that way. I kept to what I wanted. I went to London. I started my own life there. And that's what happened. I worked, had a family, and that's where I am now.
If you had to do anything in the past, again, what is it that you would, change in the path that you followed in your life?
I have no regrets. I think the experience I gained is tremendous. I think there's no university that would give me that experience. That's for me personally. In terms of for the people of South Africa, I would have wanted a far better future for them than what they have at the moment. Especially the young people. The unemployment is high. Your service delivery areas are very bad. Your education system, your health, I mean just across the board. Your energy crisis that are going to come up with load sharing and everything. For them, I would have wanted a far better future. And if there was anything I could have done at that time to change that, that would be my ambition.
In conclusion, what is the main message that you seek to get across with your book?
I think it is mainly for a lot of people who have phoned in is for them to know exactly what happened at that time when I was in a struggle. And it brought about a lot of questions, a lot of answers have to be given. And that is what I hope will come out of it at the end of the day.
It is a fascinating read, undoubtedly, and it's a valuable story that you've put together. Anyone who reads the book will really be enriched, and they'll get a truly different perspective on how things had unfolded at that time. Amin, jazakumullah khair for coming to the studios and chatting to us, and all the best for the future.
Thank you, and my Ramadan Mubarak to everybody.
Amin. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make it an easy and blessed Ramadan for one and all. Jazakumullah khair, what's your plans for the next few days?
I'm hoping to return to London soon.
Okay, inshallah. All the best. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our Ramzan is 19 hours, 18 hours. Yes.
Subhanallah. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make it easy for all in that part of the world.
And thank you for the opportunity.
It's our absolute pleasure. We appreciate you coming to the studios of Radio Islam. That was Amin Kaji, and he's released a book, Fordsburg Fighter, The Journey of an MK Volunteer. The book is on sale. Where can the book be purchased?
Exclusive books, and I think it's available on Amazon. And mainly exclusive. Just look up here. I think the people that actually published the book is Face to Face and Cover to Cover, who are very courageous in part. You know, it's a cooperative of women who have published this book, and I must thank them for it because it was. I thought nobody would publish the book anyway.
Yes, absolutely a fantastic job. We'll leave it at that. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.